All right. Hello and good afternoon. I'm just going to sort of briefly introduce the background of our project, and Harmony's going to talk a little bit more about the intervention. So this is an improved stove project that was conducted in Peru, and the two of us, as part of a Loma Linda Global Health Department team, participated in the evaluation of this project. And to go ahead and start off, we have no conflicts of interest or relationships to disclose. And so a little bit of the background on the problem that we were addressing in Peru. One of the big issues with indoor air pollution in Peru is that women cook on unventilated stoves, small homes, poor ventilation that are very smoke-filled. They have high exposure to smoke, particulate matter, and associated chemical byproducts that pose serious health hazards. And this is a high risk, of course, to women and children because they bear the burden of household responsibilities. Women are in the homes cooking, and as infants, children are often on their mother's backs during cooking time, and children stay close to mom during that time as well. So a little bit more of overview. Tuni Rakena is the community that we were in. It's a very small, rural, not just rural, but very isolated community in the southern Peruvian Andean region. And so basically the partnership included the Chinaya Foundation, and that's an NGO that has a local presence in that region, as well as Loma Linda University School of Public Health. And so the project has looked at improving stoves that would reduce indoor air pollution through better ventilation and better stove design. And that has been supported by the Chinaya Foundation. And our hope is, of course, to decrease indoor air pollution and decrease associated respiratory illnesses in women and children in this region. So just so you can see where Tuni Rakena is, it's in the southern Andean plateau. We're looking at almost 13,000 feet in elevation. And so they experience a rather harsh climate with low temperatures in winter especially. And so the partnership, again, Chinaya Foundation basically provided small loans to families. It takes about 90 U.S. dollars to purchase the materials and construct these stoves. And then as another partner in this project, our Global Health Department has provided assessment and evaluation of the project. And just also so you know, both the Chinaya Foundation and Loma Linda University have worked in this community since 2006, 2007. So it's been a long-term partnership, and we've been able to develop, you know, a good relationship with the community. And we also, this is part of a global service learning course, so students return, you know, multiple times per year. So a little bit more background on indoor air pollution. Respiratory illness has been ranked as the fourth leading cause of death among women worldwide, with indoor air pollution being a large contributor to respiratory illness, accounting for approximately 2.7% of the global disease burden. And smoke, of course, from the burning of, you know, wood, straw, dung, biomass, leads to lower respiratory infections, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and many other respiratory illnesses. And especially for children in Peru, approximately 15% of deaths in Peruvian children under 5 are attributed to acute respiratory infections, and that's the WHO stat. And also the WHO has attributed for pneumonia deaths in children under 5 in Peru, attributing approximately 50% of those to the inhalation of particulate matter in children under 5. So the biomass stove that the population is cooking on in Tuni Rakena, so just a more general stat, approximately half the world's population is still relying on biomass for daily energy needs. And as I said, that could be biomass in the form of wood, straw, dung, depending on, you know, where you are geographically and what's available. In this area, because we're at such high altitude and we are above timberline at 13,000 feet, the main source of fuel for women in Tuni Rakena is animal dung. It's an agricultural community, so there's plenty of it. The structure that you see that sort of looks like a building, that's actually a stack of dried animal dung. So they create sort of dung chips that are dried outside, and then this is sort of stacked up. And So the burning of biomass, you know, you see that sort of, you know, blackening on the walls for creosote, very traditional in your indoor air pollution environment. And we're looking at, you know, small particulate matter that's inhaled, as well as noxious chemicals that are produced as byproducts that create all types of respiratory illnesses. So Harmony's going to talk to you a little bit about the intervention.
All right. Thank you so much. So the intervention that we did was, as Heather said, the Chennai Foundation provided the funds. So they provided 30 microloans to families. The families then took these loans and they bought the materials in order to build and construct the stoves themselves. So the intervention evaluated the quality of the effectiveness of new stoves with cement chimneys and the reduction of smoke inside home. As you can see in this picture, traditional stoves didn't have any form of ventilation, so the smoke just filled the homes, and the women inhaled women and children inhaled this smoke. And the improved stoves provide chimneys that the smoke is able to escape through and exit the home, the kitchens. So a little bit more about the intervention. Like I said, the Chennai Foundation provided the funding, and originally the stoves were installed with metal chimneys. And soon after they were installed, the family started complaining that the smoke was no longer exiting their homes. Their homes were once again filling up with smoke. So in July of 2009, a group of students from Loma Linda went down and evaluated the homes, and they noticed that the metal chimneys, the material metal, was not really working properly, and the chimneys started to corrode, they rusted, and there was buildup in the metal pipes there's an L shape in the chimneys, and they're causing buildup in those areas. So, after it was discovered that the chimneys weren't working properly, the community came up with the idea that there needed to be an improvement on these stoves. So the community developed a plan to replace the metal chimneys with then brick and cement chimneys that would, the materials would help to not cause the corrosion of the metal. So in May of 2011, a group went down and sampled the particulate matter in the homes. Then the Chennai Foundation provided the funds to replace the metal chimneys with brick and cement, and then we went down in July of 2011 and we did particulate matter in the homes again, post-sampling. So how we did the particulate matter testing is we used two HazDust machines, the HazDust 1100 and the HazDust 1004. The HazDust 1100, as you can see, is this one right here. It is a instantaneous reading device. So we calibrated the machine, we went into the home, we took two readings, a reading in sitting position and a reading in standing position. The reading, we took the highest readings in the highest stabilized readings in both positions, and then for the 30 homes, and then we also, in some of the homes, we used the HazDust 1004, which is a time-weighted average machine. So we left the machine in the sitting position, or it was either connected to the women's near their breathing zone, or it was in an area sitting near them, and it recorded the time-weighted average over a half-hour period. Measurements were taken over a four-day period, and they were taken during morning and evening preparation times where women were spent the most time in the kitchens. And then a paired t-test was used to show the significance and the change of particulate matter. So as a result, there in the top result shows the time-weighted average. There was a slight decrease in the particulate matter in the homes, nothing statistically significant. In the sitting position, there was a statistically significant decrease in the home, but as you can see in the standing position, there was actually an increase in the particulate matter in the homes. As you can see, this is a diagram showing this. The sitting, there was a decrease, the standing was an increase. We are more interested in the sitting position because the women in the homes traditionally cook on small stools sitting in the room. And also the children are near the sitting area of the women. So there is a decrease in the sitting was more beneficial because that's most of the time where the women spend most of the time. As well as recording these particular matters, we also took surveys with the women in the homes that the measurements were taken. We used a GIS ArcPad. Each home that was mapped was asked three survey questions. The survey's questions were, has there been a decrease in the amount of smoke after installation? Is the fuel consumption more or less or about the same? And is the rate of cooking faster, slower, or the same within the improved soaps? These questions were asked to the women that spent the most time in the homes cooking. So the survey's result revealed that the women said that 82% of the women said that there was a less, there's less smoke in the homes. So the women believed that the homes, the improved stoves were beneficial. And then fuel consumption, 46% said that there was the same, with the next majority saying that there was less. And then the final survey is the rate of cooking. 61% of the women said that the stoves cooked faster, which we were happy to find out because the less time that the women have to spend in the homes cooking, the less time that they inhaled the smoke. So we are happy to find that out. Just a little bit of information. Based on the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency standards in the home, where we measured the PM10 were well above the recommended levels. The EPA standards is that levels of 0.15 milligrams per meters cubed in a 24-hour period should not be exceeded more than once per year. As you can see, they were well above standards, but it's difficult with using these improved stoves. It is difficult to meet these standards, but this is a goal that we would like to achieve. Future work is that we want to improve the current model. As you could, this is the current model, and under these pans are open holes that the heat goes through. As soon as you remove the pans from cooking or to serve, the smoke just goes straight out the holes and into the room. So we would recommend that a metal sheet be fitted to those holes so that when removing the pans, the smoke doesn't escape into the kitchens. And also, we also, as we were there, we went around the areas and we tried to find improved models that we could then use in this, in these homes, because we think that if the models were more standardized, it would be better, and also we want to continue to decrease the production of smoke in the homes. So limitations of the study, real quick, is, like I said, the community designed these stoves, each individual family built the stoves, so there's a lot of differences in the stoves, and then the weather difference between May and July varied, so those could affect the readings. So in conclusion, the goal of lowering the particulate matter concentrations within the homes was achieved. Although the community did identify problems with the original stoves, but the Shania Foundation was quick to address these problems in providing the funds in order to redo the stoves with the cement and metal chimneys. The locals did identify a solution of using the cement chimneys, so the locals took ownership of the stoves, which is really good to see. They took ownership in this project and intervention, and they made it their own by designing stoves and trying to figure out how they can. They understand, in our town meeting, they understand the importance of these stoves and the importance of decreasing the respiratory illness. And so they're taking ownership of the project, and they're really doing as much as they can in order to decrease it as well. So there were still issues with the stoves, and our recommendations are to redesign the stoves. So.
Chairs so that everybody can be seated up here. Thank you all for staying very much on time, and special thanks to Dr. Gold, who I cut off early. And so if you have extra questions for her, she deserves it. They're tricky. You have to lean them in and pull them out. It's high tech. Thank you so much. If you want to sit here so that I have the projector blocked, that would be fine. Just to remind you, who may not remember way back at the beginning of the session, our first speaker was Dr. Gold, who was here, who spoke on the postpartum depression of mothers to newborns in Ghana. Our second speaker was Dr. Landry, there she is, who talked about the very important issue of obstetric fistula in several countries. Our next speaker was Martine Holston, who covered the use of misoprostol by TBAs. Then Sarah Shannon spoke on the Hesperian efforts with the mobile apps. And our last speaker, of course, you just heard. I will start off by asking our last speakers where they were. I did a project in Kenya many years ago where we did a similar thing. And we found that families were concerned because the open fire had been a source of warmth. Did you get any commentary on whether or not the stoves now decrease the warmth that were available from cooking?
That wasn't something that we surveyed. However, being in the home, I guess we got firsthand experience. So the stoves are currently more efficient because they are much more contained. When you're in there, they are, I think, from our standards, the smoke is still really, really high. So, I mean, you can see a noticeable level, like, between the sitting and standing position where you sort of have this thick layer of smoke. So it's still pretty warm. A lot of that is just because the structures are so small, or, you know, height and dimension.
Thank you. It was a major complaint in Kenya, mm-hmm. So it's interesting. Questions, please, for any of our speakers. Sir?
Snow ladies. They don't have either air or rain on the Altiplano. It would seem a perfect opportunity for solar cooking. Have you thought of that?
Mm-hmm. No, we haven't. So we spent some time around the local community. This is obviously an issue in the whole region, not just in the community of Kenya. And there are a lot of local artisans that are exploring different designs. And different ceramic designs and a little bit more contained energy efficient designs. That's not something that we had seen. One thing that has been explored somewhat, just because dung is the main fuel that they have and it's so plentiful, there are better models that might do better with like gas digesting stoves that could burn the dung more efficiently and also produce beneficial agricultural output.
Questions? Yes, please.
I have a question for Dr. Cole. Maybe I read this wrong, but one of the results that you presented was that home birth was associated with increased risk of postpartum depression. Mm-hmm. Do you have any theory about why that is, or if it's acting as a surrogate of some other marker?
I would have thought it was acting as a surrogate, except that the demographics weren't significant. So I'm a little bit curious why that is. I think there may be unmeasured factors that we've not quite picked up on. There was a low number in this particular population who actually had home birth, but I think it's something that's pretty important for future studies.
Perhaps depression lowered their ability to respond to problems. Just questions? Yes, please.
I also have a question for Craig.
Me?
Marianne?
Martine.
So you mentioned that there were 5 referrals throughout the study.
Mm-hmm.
How did that compare to, did you do a baseline?
We didn't have a baseline, but if you just think about there being 2,441 women, that's really low.
It does seem quite low, but
we didn't have that ability just because the TBAs weren't completing paperwork before the project. So.
Did you get many reports of the soaked clothing with the use of this
crossover? No, only the 6.
Super.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, ma'am.
I have a question about the system. At the end, you talked a little bit about after women had undergone surgery, what are the issues with reintroduction or re-socialization? How complicated is that, or how involved is that? Is that a really big deal? Or?
I think it depends on the communities. Our study, the limitation is that we only have 3-month follow-up. So we really don't know how long it took women to be reintegrated back into their communities. Johns Hopkins University is undertaking a study right now with a longer-term follow-up. They've done it, I think, in Bangladesh, and they're beginning in another country where they're doing a 12-month follow-up, and they really are focusing more on the social reintegration. Our study was more of a clinical study, and so we had, you know, a few measures about how their lives have improved after this very short period post-surgery.
Gentleman at the back.
I'll stand up. Two past questions. One about the fistula. I might have been busy sort of tweeting over it, and I might have missed the slide, but I'm interested in outcomes of women who have had surgery and not rehabilitation, as opposed to women who have also had either pre- or post-operative rehabilitation for fistula, whether it's a result of physiotherapy, and not necessarily going to community reintegration, but more the clinic outcomes. And the second was about the Ghana and the mental health. You talked about her being...
Well, why don't you hold that question? Okay. Let's hear, and I'll call on you again.
I'm not 100% sure I understand your question. Meaning women who had fistula, whether they had surgery or some other kind of non-surgical intervention?
No, rehabilitation services. So surgery and then...
Well, throughout women's post-operative care, they get physical therapy if they need it. There's, you know, pelvic floor exercises are usually taught. So all that's part of the ongoing care. Some women may have some other services provided in the post-operative period. I don't really have the data to be able to address that, but it's kind of a standard care in these facilities.
So all of the women who you studied would have had that?
They probably did have some physical therapy if they needed it, and definitely some education and teaching about pelvic floor exercises.
These might be being recorded, so if you could repeat the question.
Oh, I forgot about that.
And your next question?
Yeah, it was more over psychology versus psychiatry than mentioning that there's a psychiatrist, but in normal routes they wouldn't normally be referred to as psychiatrists, it's more normally psychology. I'm just wondering about the systems in Ghana, whether psychiatry is a catch-all for anything that's related to psychiatric disorders and psychological distress.
That's a great question, and it's important, I think, in a low-resource country where there are very limited numbers of very highly trained people. At this particular hospital, there are 6 or 7 psychologists, and we did a separate study, which I didn't talk about, where we interviewed physicians and midwives about postpartum depression and recognition and diagnosis, and many of them said, oh, I would refer to the psychologist, but the truth is, that's really not happening at a hospital with 14,000 births and 6 psychologists who are mostly treating other things. So yes, it's true that psychologists could play an important role in terms of counseling, but those referrals are not being made by anybody currently. So it's an important issue for the future.
Other questions, please? Yes, sir.
Dr. Landry, are you saying that you had such good surgeons? That's a difficult surgery. Are you saying you had such good surgeons that you had 100% success rate with the operation?
I didn't say we had 100% success rate.
How did you measure that? And then where did your surgeons get their training?
Surgeons have been trained, well, first of all, the success. I didn't even give the statistics on the success rate. So in this study, about 66% of the women at the 3-month follow-up had a closed and dry fistula. And 34% had either the fistula was not closed or they had some remaining incontinence. Surgeons are trained by visiting surgeons internationally or by a growing cadre of in-country surgeons who are master trainers now. So that's one of the objectives of our project has really been to build the capacity of in-country surgeons. So fistula surgery is not always successful, and there's a paper that's been published, which if you're interested, I could give you the citation for it, about the clinical outcomes of the study. Because not all women had a simple fistula, someone had very difficult fistulas, and so surgery is not always successful for those women.
Other questions before I take it back? Yes, go ahead.
This question is for Sarah. Sarah, does Experian have plans to develop other apps?
That's a nice question, thank you. Yeah, we would. Actually, again, as the Luddite in my organization, it was a lot of fun. It was really interesting. What we're doing is we're developing a lot of new content, actually, for along the lines of NCDs and other sort of information for new and emerging health issues that community health workers should be tackling. And we're thinking about, as we develop new content, packaging it as well in a way that is for an app. Now, whether, again, the way we approach apps is that our approach is like the books, they're designed so that somebody else can then in turn repackage them. So it's thinking about, can we package this information in a way that app developers and mHealth developers can then more easily use. So yes, we hope to do more of that in the future.
In the front row?
Another question for you. What if any limitations do you see as to how far you can go with trying to do this with an app?
Well, one of the limitations right now is technology, because we did experiment earlier with sort of giving information in text message kinds of units, and I can tell you there are real limitations to that. So that was actually one reason we tried to go for more like the smartphone route, not because we think that smartphones are in health workers' hands right now necessarily, but they may well be in the course of the next few years. By then, we'll probably be surprised by yet some other developments that actually make even more kinds of things possible. So technology is one limitation just in terms of how much information and how you can convey it. Our challenge is that we are used to thinking of information in two-page spreads in a book. And so to think about how to chunk the information into small enough units that it's kind of workable in a mobile phone environment was our biggest learning area. And I think is truly a challenge because you want people to continue to think about big picture issues while they're getting very concrete information. And that can be really hard to do in a very small space, like a screenshot on a cell phone.
Well, there were hands in the back, I thought. Any other questions? I'm going to take the moderator's prerogative then to ask a couple questions. Actually, I should do it right here. Just to follow on, do you know what percentage of your target audience has such phones now?
I don't have the statistics in front of me, but the percentage of smartphones has increased in developing countries overall by about 29% in the last year, something like that. How it breaks down across countries is, of course, really variable, but it's changing really rapidly. I know anecdotally of a number of community health worker projects where, again, the community health worker themselves did not purchase the phone, but they are using smartphones or using iPods, actually, which are much less expensive than an iPhone. So we're seeing more and more of that, just even in the last year. It's changing.
And I have a question for Dr. Landry, if you would. I started to ask you this, but what is it, do you think, about the deliveries, or is it female genital mutilation? What is it, do you think, that is causing these very early fistula development in Nigeria as opposed to later in countries like Bangladesh?
Well, I think that just, I don't know, women marry at a younger age. I don't really know that answer to tell you the truth. I mean, some of the fistulas may be caused by female genital mutilation, but it's very small percentage. There's actually growing evidence that, or anecdotal evidence that there's more iatrogenic fistulas happening with forced urinary infections. But I really don't know why the difference is in Nigeria compared to the other countries.
Thank you.
Still research questions.
The question for the stove ladies, as they've been called, what is the cost of implementing a project like this to actually put in a new stove?
The new stoves cost about $90.
Okay, and the installation?
The families installed them themselves.
Aha, maybe that's the issue.
Yeah. So each of the families were given the materials that cost $90, and then they took initiative to install them. But the Chennai Foundation did provide people who are expert in this area to help them in designing stoves.
Thank you. I just wondered, Martine, if you could comment on the difference. You did say that it's easier to use the pills rather than the oxytocin, the synthetosin and things. Is there any cost comparison? Because I know the oxytocins have a very short shelf life and refrigeration and all that.
Unfortunately, I don't have numbers in front of me to really comment. Basically, the price can end up being comparable, if not cheaper, for misoprostol, just because the manufacturing costs of the drug is much lower. And obviously, there's no cost involved with keeping the drug. There's no storage costs, such as the refrigeration, et cetera, for oxytocin. And there's also no associated costs for like the syringe and all of that.
And I would like to give Dr. Gold the last word, if I could.
I found your presentation really intriguing because I come from kind of a program, what can we do about it background. And I cut you off before you had a chance to fully expound on that. How do you think we might address this in a cost-effective manner?
So I've been thinking a lot about that just as we've kind of been building on this program. One of the things I've been interested in is whether we could set up some peer support systems. You know, when you look at the moms who have sick babies, they're all there together, but there's not a lot of talking to each other and a lot of support. And so in a few countries, they have set up some group processes. They don't do a lot of group treatments in Ghana, but that seems to me that something might be sustainable. And also perhaps training some of the nurses who work in these kinds of settings with high-risk women to do this kind of work. We actually did apply to NIH for a grant to develop such an intervention. Even though they said they wanted developing grants, they seemed to want something that was much more already developed and tested. So that's kind of where we're going in the future. So part of interviewing physicians and midwives is to build in what do people know about education in that country? What do people know about recognizing mental illness besides things like psychosis and postpartum psychosis? And what can we do in terms of both education and interventions?
I'm finding women places to go.
Places to go, medications. You know, most of the major psychotropic medications are available there, but nobody's really trained to use them. They're expensive. People don't have the resources to use them. So we really need to kind of start with what's cheap and accessible and build from there, I think.
Thank you. I want to thank all the panelists. This was a really exciting session. Thank you very much, and thank you, audience, for your questions.